Google's network doesn't exist. We show you how to keep your fiber clean, and we've got a virtualized jamboree on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for the following show is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 13, recorded September 21, 2012, for October 8, 2012. Heads in the Clouds.
This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a new mobile phone service that makes sense. You save money with Ting because you pay only for what you use. It doesn't require a contract, and Ting offers unlimited devices on one pool plan. To save $50 on your first Ting device, visit enterprise.ting.com. That's enterprise.ting.com. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone to get a second one free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And buy social media solutions from SAP. If you're a social media manager at a large enterprise, gain insight and engage in social media in a systematic way with social media solutions from SAP. Learn more at sap.com/twit.
Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And I am joined with a super panel today for virtualization, starting with our in-studio guest, Mr. John Troyer from VMware Evangelist. John, thank you very much for coming on.
Robert, thanks for having me on.
Now, tell me a little bit, what is it that you do for VMware?
I wish I could explain it. I'm on the social media team. So I work with social media. I work with our bloggers. I work with our community of hundreds of thousands of customers, as well as going out and talking about virtualization.
So pretty much if anyone's ever gone to a VMware conference, they've probably seen you around somewhere.
I am often around. I've been known to wear some shiny coat every now and then and get up and dance, you know, that sort of thing. They pay me to be a clown.
And you just finished up a big event here in San Francisco not too long ago. I believe one of your tweets was that you were about to slip into a coma after the event. What was that?
VMworld San Francisco, 20,000 people in downtown San Francisco. Actually, we're just about to do VMworld Barcelona as this episode is shown. And that'll be on October 9th to the 11th. And so another 5,000 or 6,000, 7,000 people there.
Well, fantastic. It's nice to have your experience on the show. And you were actually demanded by our fans, both in the chat room and on the Twitter feed, when I asked them, who do you want to see on from VMware? Your name was sort of unanimous. So welcome and thank you for coming on.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Now, of course, it's not just VMware. We've also got a couple of different perspectives, starting with our regular guest, the brains behind Twyatt, Mr. Brian Chi, evangelist for ThinLinks. Brian, how is Honolulu?
Honolulu is rainy, but that's not bad because we need the water.
You need the water. Wait a minute. You're surrounded by water. What are you talking about?
Oh, water, water everywhere. Not a drop to drink. No, we've actually got a severe drought going on the Big Island, and people are having to actually fly in bales of hay for the cattle.
Ooh, okay. Wow. Okay, that's different. Now, you have deep, deep roots in Microsoft products, and especially Microsoft virtualization products. So you have promised to be nice to our guest from VMware, yes?
Actually, I consider myself to be an appropriate technology fan. I use VMware, I use Hyper-V, I use Zen Server, I use all of the above. I play with all of them and will continue playing with them. In fact, I run the world's largest Linux mirror site, and that's running on KVM.
We love that. Okay, good, good. You're showing your multi-platform roots. Now, right next to you is Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, it's great to have you back. How are things on the left coast?
Well, down here in Florida, we are also enjoying the tail end of the rainy season, and the swamp just keeps getting deeper, which is also a good description of what's happening in a lot of enterprise IT today. So it works out well.
Nice. And actually, coming back after a long absence is Mr. Oliver Rist. Oliver, you were invited to a couple of shows, but you were biking across America. What was this?
Yes, I was taking my motorcycle down the right-hand coast and then coming up through the central California and central Oregon, and it was a fantastic tour. Had a great time.
Well, welcome back. It's time to get to work. Okay, now, we do want to get into the virtualization story, but first we're starting with an enterprise bite. This time we've got a story about Google's super secret network. If you've been watching the trade papers for a while or reading stories about Google, you know that they run a massive worldwide network. In fact, most people estimate that they probably have the second largest amount of fiber in ground that they own, going from colo to colo, second only to level three for the size of a worldwide network. And, well, they've just been doing some interesting things with it. Oh, there's a story here from Wired about how, I'm sorry, does anyone know how to pronounce his name? Urls Holzl? Anyone? Bueller?
No.
Bueller? Okay, I'm just going to call him Urs because I can't pronounce his last name correctly. He was brought in as sort of the infrastructure czar from Google, and he has done some amazing things with their network as of late. One of the first things that he did was to move them to OpenFlow, which is a protocol developed by Stanford. Chibert, you and I both have a little bit of experience dealing with OpenFlow. Do you remember? I mean, I know it separates the management traffic from the actual routing responsibilities within a switch, but what does Google use OpenFlow for?
Well, you know, Cisco has NetFlow, and, you know, there's all, you know, different types of flow monitoring systems. OpenFlow is basically non-proprietary. It is open source. So the interop people at the Las Vegas show actually ran in iLabs, which is a technology demonstration area, and they actually had lots and lots of different types of equipment all being put together that talked OpenFlow. So you can actually monitor the flows going through your infrastructure and do some interesting things. So the video that's being played now is a demonstration that Stanford did where they used the OpenFlow to control how data was routed around the network. So the video is of these guys driving around in a golf cart, and the OpenFlow is actually controlling their primary path through the Wi-Fi network on the Stanford campus. It's a pretty cool demonstration.
Yeah, we were actually trying to duplicate that demonstration back at Interop, and it's really, really difficult to do if you're trying to build the management into the same piece of silicon that's also handling the packet switching and the routing. So if you take that responsibility and offload it to another server and make another server responsible for where devices are, and the switches just act as big, dumb routers, you get a nice little performance boost, but you also get to do things like this, like what you're seeing in the video, which is impossible using the standard switch model. Now, Curtis, have you heard of OpenFlow, played with OpenFlow at all?
Certainly know about OpenFlow. Now, I haven't had a chance to bring up a server with OpenFlow, but I've been following the news closely, and I think that there are some interesting things going on with it. Obviously, we're seeing some very big players adopting it, but I think that, pardon me, I think that a lot of enterprises have been carefully watching the organization that's growing up around OpenFlow, and some of the news coming out of VMware's participation and now Red Hat's participation are, I think, just about to make a big difference in the way a lot of enterprises view OpenFlow as a candidate for something they would be interested in seeing implemented in their own infrastructure.
All right. Now, it's not only OpenFlow. And OpenFlow has actually been a big draw at Interop the last couple of years. We've had our Interop Labs team come and actually demonstrate how OpenFlow could run on existing switches. But part of this story is also that Google has been creating their own 10-gig gear. These interesting boxes, now known as Pluto, were mistakenly sent to a fulfillment center somewhere in middle America, and the IT guys who opened them up spent a few days trying to figure out exactly what they were. They used non-standard ports. They had unmarked chips. They had a very strange interface. They couldn't really talk to them. They knew there were high-performance switches. They didn't know who they were until they were actually able to talk to a Google representative and figure out that these were these new, custom-built Google switches. Oliver, have you heard about this story at all, or have you heard about Google making their own switches?
I've been watching OpenStack. I haven't been paying attention to Google, but it doesn't surprise me that they're doing it.
Yeah. And one of the cool things about this is when you start looking at the capabilities of the switch, I mean, they were just kind of backwards engineering a few things. You're talking about a top-of-the-line product, something that can do 10 gig in both directions that nobody else has. It's all custom. Now, John, why would Google want to do something like that? I mean, why would they want to go through the expense, the time, the resource-intensive task of creating their own switch when there are plenty of really good high-performance 10-gig switches on the market right now?
What you're seeing with folks like Google and like Facebook, people that are operating at the internet scale, they're really trying to push the automated data center, the software-defined data center, really farther than what's commercially available on the market. So they build their own servers. They build their own switches. They're really operating at a very high level of automation in terms of number of servers or number of routers and switches per admin, far more than in any normal company.
Right, and that's one of the things that they get if they custom design their own gear, which is they get to make it for their use case. They don't have to figure out how to make their hierarchy, their structure work with the gear. The gear was designed to work with what they already have. Now, following up on that story, actually, also is this little Wired article about how Google is one of two companies, Facebook is the other, that also gets to order chips directly from Intel, gets to order custom Intel and AMD chips to suit their server farm. So they don't have to wait for the latest and greatest. They can actually say, this is what we need. Chibert, put this in the context of custom switches, of OpenFlow, and of a private network that is second to none, and well, except for level 3. What does this ability to customize their own gear do for Google?
a lot of people have been really tempted to go and design their own switches. And now with the single board computers that are available, this is becoming lots easier. Now, I do have a correction. Those Pluto switches, I actually got a chance to blow up one of the images. And that is actually an industry standard port. It's the new 40 gig optics. It's a little wider than an SFP Plus and shorter, but it's got a much firmer connector and a lot more ground pins so you can handle the 40 gig throughput. They're also probably running things like Open vSwitch, so they have control and they can actually modify the switch code. And they're also running OpenFlow. So the cool thing about it is they can get rid of all the extra features they don't need and really strip the switch down so that they can have the maximum possible performance and only add in the management pieces they absolutely positively need. We've done that a couple times for some different types of equipment within the scientific community, but it's not something you do often because debugging a switch is really a pain.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the things that the guys were looking at when they were looking at the interface. It was unlike anything they'd ever seen. I mean, it's definitely not industry standard. But again, you know, if they can only include the features that they need, if the box is only running the protocols and the functions that are required for Google's massive amounts of data, then that's definitely a plus on their side. Curtis, I want to give you the last word on this. When you're looking at Google designing their own switches and servers, there was a question in the chat room about, well, why would they do that when all the minds for designing those pieces of gear are at HP or Cisco or Extreme or Netgear? Why go through the cost and the trouble of designing a privately designed network if, you really don't have to?
Well, I think that the reason that they do this goes back to money, because frankly, if you're building out a switch infrastructure or data centers, thousands of boxes at a time, as Google will be doing, then it makes sense to go ahead and design in everything possible rather than buy something that was designed by someone else and have to go through any customization at all on site. Being able to buy it, have it shipped, plug it in, and let it work is the cheapest, most effective way to get both the performance and the economic advantages that you need. And one thing that I'll say, now we make a great deal about Facebook and Google being able to order chips from Intel. Frankly, anyone can do that as long as you're willing to place orders in the quantities that will get them to fire up the foundries for you. Or to use some of the blank areas on the dies for you. So anyone who was ordering chips in quantities of tens of thousands at a time could probably pull this off. It says a lot about the infrastructure that Google and Facebook are the notable ones who are actually doing it right now.
Sorry to interrupt, Brickhouse Padre, but I want to take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Ting.com. Now, what is Ting? Ting is a different kind of no BS mobile service provider. Now, what does that mean? It means that there are no contracts or early termination fees. Ting doesn't bundle useless features into your service plan. You only pay for what you need. They also don't charge you for services that should be free. Voicemail, caller ID, tethering, hotspot, three-way calling, call forwarding, and other features are all part of service. There are no overages or penalties. There's no gotcha. If you use more than you thought you would, Ting just charges you for what you used. You also get credits on unused services. If you use less than you thought you would, Ting drops you down to the level you hit and credits the difference on your next bill. Ting gives you access to pooled resources. You buy one plan, then have as many devices as you want on that one plan. All your gear shares your minutes, messages, and megabytes for a flat $6 per month per device. I'm also a big fan of billing transparency. Ting doesn't try to hide behind fees or recovery charges. They charge you for what you use, collect the taxes that they're legally required to collect, and it's all spelled out in English on your bill. Ting also gives you the power to use your plan and devices as you need to, with a powerful online account control panel that lets you see your usage and your bills, to a live support line that runs between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern, to an active online support forum that has an online ticketing system, video tutorials, and the works. Now, this is how it works. You purchase your new mobile device from Ting, and you get it within 2 to 5 business days. Then you activate your device, and you have the option to select a new number or to port an existing number. Finally, you select the monthly minutes, messages, and megabytes that you think represents your usage, and Ting will bill you at the beginning of your payment period. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to visit Ting today at enterprise.ting.com. You can save money and better manage your mobile phone service with Ting. Check out their savings calculator and see how much you or your company can save. Twiet viewers also save $50 on their first Ting device when they sign up. So visit enterprise.ting.com and sign up today. And we thank Ting for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Now, speaking of Google's fiber networks, we've got a video here that's going to show you why it's important to keep your optics clean.
Hi, I'm Tyler Vanderplug from JDSU, and today we're here at Interop, and we're building this very high bandwidth network. And one of the biggest things that we're paying attention to today is making sure that all of our fiber connections are in pristine condition and clean enough to transfer the data from each server to server or to each cabinet. And so I wanted to walk through one of the products that we're using in doing this and how it makes it a lot easier. Around my neck here, I have what we call our Essential Fiber Toolkit from JDSU. It features our popular HP3 series integrated system, which combines three tools in one, actually. It includes a microscope for inspecting the patch cords, which I'll do in a moment. Also a second microscope for inspecting the connector behind the bulkhead. And it also includes an integrated power meter. And there's other tools included with it, such as a visual fault locator, cleaning tools, and things of that nature. So I'd like to walk through just the process of how this is used right here on an actual system that's being used on the Interop floor. We'll start off by checking our test leads on one of our patch cords. So I'll turn on my device, and I have my integrated patch cord microscope here. So I'll check that. I'll check the first connector, and it's pretty dirty. So right next to my microscope, I have an integrated cleaner. Give that a click and reinspect that. Now I've validated that end is clean. So I can actually move it over here to my power meter port. Whether I'm using my power meter or not, I can put it there because it's a nice safe place to park that connector when you're not using it. Check my other end. This one as well is pretty dirty, so I'll give that a clean. Now that's a lot better. So now both of these ends are ready to go. But before I connect those, I want to make sure that the connector behind the bulkhead port is also clean. I'm now going to transition over to my probe microscope, which allows me to inspect behind the bulkhead port. I press a button on my display here. That activates the probe. I'll go ahead and inspect that in here. Get that into focus. And that one is pretty dirty. I'm going to check both at the same time. And both of them are pretty dirty. So my cleaning tool, the same device that I used to clean the patch cord ends, I can also use to clean behind the bulkhead. I just remove the cap. Give that a few clicks in there. And now I'm going to reinspect. Now I've confirmed that both my patch cord side and the connectors behind the bulkhead are clean. So I can move ahead and actually connect those. Now, I need to plug in the other side. Now, on this particular application, that side used an SC connector. On the other side is using an LC connector. So in order to inspect this one and clean it, I just need to change the adapters. This one here was meant for a universal 2.5 interface. I'm going to put on a different adapter for a 1.25 interface, which is what you'll usually see on an LC ferrule. Now I need to do the same with my bulkhead. I had an SC tip on there for inspecting the SC port. I'm going to change that out to an LC tip instead. Put that on there and thread that. Now I'm all ready to go to inspect the LC patch cords and the ports behind there. So I go ahead and get this into focus. Actually, both of these are in great condition, which is another good reason why you always want to inspect before you connect, because if you don't need to clean, you don't need to waste the time doing that if you've already validated that these ends are clean. So now these two ends are clean. I'm going to toggle over to activate my probe microscope. And hey, guess what? All of these ends are actually already clean. So we've validated now that these ends are clean, and we didn't even have to check them. Let's hear it for interop. We got some clean connectors here. So now I've validated that those ends are clean, so I can plug that in. And now I've connected both ends of my SC and my LC over here and made sure that every end face was perfectly clean. And remember, inspect before you connect.
Now, Chiebert, inspect before you connect. I remember when I first started working at Interop with you, this was the extent of our cleaning. We don't do that anymore, right? What do you remember? Some of the nightmare scenarios of plugging in dirty fiber into our network.
Oh, the worst time was when we were running a 10 gig backbone down into the over to the colos. Someone had taken a dirty patch cable that had some just concrete dust on it, just from walking around the concrete floors. And concrete has this really bad habit of creating spikes. And someone just plugged that straight into some 10 gig optics and actually spiked the optics, and we lost a $7,000 10 gig interface.
Right.
I mean, I said I was sorry.
Oliver, that's why you're not invited back. You know that, right? No, that's actually one of the things that a lot of people don't realize. That is, if you've ever used fiber optics, it looks robust. It looks really tough. But the problem is, if there's any dirt on this and you take it and you plug it into this module, you've now just contaminated the module. And so the guys at JDSU have really, they've given us the tools and they've given us the practice of inspecting every single connector before it goes into the network. It sounds tedious, and it is tedious, but I mean, the end result is you get a network that works. Now, you know, if you've got to run like this, it's just, you know, a few feet or just a meter or two, that's one thing. But if you're starting to deal with the distances that we have at these conferences where we're running a couple of hundred feet or, a couple of hundred meters, you really need clean optics and you really need clean connectors to get the speeds that you want. Now, Chiebert, you have a lot of experience with fiber optics, but what would be the one thing that you would give? What advice would you give to anyone who's looking at really starting to play with long run fiber?
It's basically just confirm that your contractors actually did the correct degree of polishing, make sure it all gets certified, and really clean and inspect. You need to be really, really anal about making sure your fiber is clean. You might get away with it for 100FX. You might get away with it gig. But boy, I tell you, 10 gig and 40 gig, and now I'm starting to play with 100 gig. Dirty fiber or dirty connectors can really ruin your whole day.
Now, we're going to follow this up with an actual review of some of that JDSU gear that you saw. We're going to show you the ins and outs and why you should be looking at getting that if you're an actual professional working in this field. But I think we can just say, clean before you connect.
When we built the new studio, we chose to do everything we could in the cloud. Hold meetings, share files, schedule tapings. We didn't want a clunky old PBX system in the basement. So when Russell, our IT guy, told us that we could get a cloud-based phone system from RingCentral, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. Zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling in one easy-to-use service. Our producers love getting their voicemail in their email, and we can even get all of our fax messages right on our smartphones. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing, as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second one free for up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Again, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. We thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Now to the main event. This is what you wanted. This is what you asked for. And so we're bringing it straight to you. Virtualization. Now, John, there's a lot of different ideas of what virtualization is and what VDI is. Why don't you straighten us out from the VMware perspective? What is virtualization?
Well, virtualization is taking a physical machine and turning it into software that runs on another machine. I kind of use it like the Matrix. The computer still thinks it has a NIC, it thinks it has a disk, it thinks it has a keyboard, but really it's a piece of software that's running on another server.
Now, we've seen this done all the way down to the consumer level. In fact, a few weeks ago, Iaz on KnowHow actually talked about how to create a virtual machine. And he went through the advantages of having a virtual machine that you could open up, that you didn't have to worry about getting infected, that you didn't have to worry about getting destroyed by malicious software. It's a great idea, but it really started with the enterprise. Cheebert, virtualization, I mean, how has it come about and how is it affecting the industry right now?
Virtualization, in my mind, is all about the money. You know, if you're running a straight web server, you're probably barely getting out of single-digit utilization. Wouldn't it be great to be able to go and run that sucker in the sweet spot up in like 60, 70, 80% utilization, make better use of the hardware? And, oh, by the way, now everybody can have the root access to their own server. So being able to go and accommodate the needs of, accounting or accommodate the needs of development, but still have the ability to have control over that. It's kind of going back to all the really good things about mainframe, but all the good things about PCs.
Now, Curtis, when we talk about virtualization, who are the players? I mean, let's go through the major players. Who would you say are competing for your virtualization dollar?
Well, you have three huge players. You have, of course, VMware. You have Microsoft. And you have Citrix. Each of these has their adherents. Each of them has their own way of doing things. Each one is a little bit different, but for 90 to 95% of all enterprise installations, one of those three big players is going to be who is sitting between the virtual machine and the real hardware.
Okay, and I want to go to Oliver for this one, which is, when we hear about virtualization, we often connect it with VDI, with the virtual desktop infrastructure. Why are those two always seemingly connected?
Virtual desktop infrastructure, by the by the token of its name, is basically taking the concept of virtualization and pushing it out to the desktop. It has a few more interesting possibilities than straight virtual machine management. But in my opinion, it's one of the coolest advances in how people use virtualization to date. It'll let administrators add, you know, multiple desktops for single users. It adds multiple users for a single desktop. It lets people who are roaming or far away use a virtual machine that's managed and at the corporate site. There's all kinds of possibilities. So yeah, that's my take.
All right. Well, John, throwing it back to you. You know, we know that there are three main players. We've heard a little bit about why you'd want to virtualize. We know that it can save money. We know that it's a better way to do things. What would you say are some of the main differences between how the players approach virtualization?
Well, look, they all have their pros and cons. I think as people look at the solution that's right for them, they have to go over their requirements and what works for them. One of the main issues that people don't consider is that to look at the total cost of ownership of what they're going to buy. They look at the license cost up front and don't consider, does that include management? Does that include disaster recovery? Does that include provisioning and automation? And also, what's going to be the overall operational cost to run this thing? So if you look down a series of checkboxes, you know, everybody likes to do those matrices with like green checkboxes and red X's. One green checkbox does not equal another, and you really have to go in and dig down a little bit deeper and find out you know, what's involved in the features. So, you know, VMware, market leader, been around for 10 years, focuses on virtualization, cloud, our latest product suite we call the vCloud suite, which includes vSphere and vCloud Director and a lot of other products like that. And so we're really trying to make things simple, make things robust, and make things production ready. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's what, and then Microsoft obviously is building on top of Windows Server 2012, and virtualization is part of the operating system. So everybody has kind of a different take on it. But I think really once people look at the operational costs and how that maps to the requirements, that's the way to start on the journey anyway.
Okay, good. Yeah, so you look at what you need and you look at which vendor can provide you what you need at a price that you can pay, basically.
And a price that you can pay over the lifetime of the solution, right? So if you look at a desktop, if you look at the operational cost of running a desktop, analysts will tell you it costs maybe $4,000 or $5,000 to run over 3 years. Going to a virtual desktop, if you're making the migration to Windows 7 or something like that, if you greatly reduce, you can repurpose your existing laptops, you can buy thin clients, you can reduce your hardware costs on that side, but you greatly reduce your operational cost because you're taking the operating system and all the maintenance and all those help desk visits to somebody. So while you're sitting there watching something reboot, you're moving that back into the data center. It's easier to patch, easier to manage, easier to roll back when something goes wrong. You can end up saving $500 a year per desktop just by switching over to a virtual desktop infrastructure versus having physical desktops.
Okay. I want to throw that over to Curtis. Curtis, so when we start looking at these virtualized services, and when we talk about how these virtualized services start getting pushed off to clients through VDI, when you're deploying a thin client in your enterprise, are you tying yourself to one of these virtualizations, or is it possible to move back and forth, to say from a VMware infrastructure to a Microsoft infrastructure to a Citrix infrastructure, depending on how your needs change and grow?
Well, in theory, you certainly can change, but in practice, once a company makes the decision to go down one path, it's going to take an awful lot to change their direction. And the reasons are the same, that they tend to stay with one supplier for network switches or even hardware servers. Once you have the infrastructure in place, once you have the training in place, and perhaps is important, once you have the vendor and integrator and supplier relationships in place, then it takes an awful lot to change direction. That's why salespeople love what they call the green field opportunities, where there is no incumbent. But for most companies, making that initial decision is critical because it's a decision they're going to live with for a long, long time.
Oliver, I do want to throw it to you because you represent What is a wild card here? It's not one of the big three players, but it is definitely something that's been growing when you start looking at virtualized services themselves or internet as a service, which is OpenStack. Could you describe OpenStack, what it does, and what's been happening over the past couple of months as you've tracked the story?
Well, if I was going to be snarky about it, I would say that OpenStack to date might be the largest vapor project ever, but I'm not. I'm actually very excited by it. It's an open source cloud operating system movement. So it started about 18 months ago. It's moving very, very quickly. If I had to sum it up, what I love about it is the fact that companies, no offense, like VMware or Microsoft or Citrix, are limited in innovation by the fact that they have to package an existing product in a cloud wrapper and push it into the cloud marketplace. OpenStack, they make this point, they can design for the cloud from the ground up. They're starting at ground zero, and then supposedly, and we hope that lets them come up with innovations for cloud computing that we haven't even thought of yet. I haven't seen that yet, but I'm hoping that that it'll happen. As far as virtual desktop infrastructure goes, again, just like most things OpenStack, that's on the way. They've made some recent announcements about new partners and new people who are going to be contributing to this project. But you're not going to see anything, I think, at the earliest until 2013. That's the fulsome release. And I expect it wouldn't be really usable until the release after that or even the release after that. So at least 2 years, probably.
I spoke with you about OpenStack a while back. You actually interviewed me for a story that you were doing about OpenStack. And I told you about a deployment, I won't say competition, but it was really a comparison that some of our universities were doing. And they were looking at some of the biggest solutions out there. And they were very excited by OpenStack, but ultimately they were a little disappointed because of something you mentioned, and that is the features that they wanted always seemed to be on the horizon. They were almost there. They were almost there. And I believe the quote that you used in your story was, ultimately they went for Microsoft because even though they weren't particularly happy with the performance, at least they knew it. At least they knew how bad it was, and it was consistently bad.
Yeah. Actually, I think it was your quote, and it was a little more snarky in the sense that I think Microsoft, it may taste like meatloaf, but it gets the job done. So, I do want to point out, actually, I think that group went with Office 365, right?
Right. Ultimately, they went with 365.
Right, which is that's a perfect example. I don't even think Microsoft knows that it's a leader there. I don't think they've actually figured that out. That's the only application I've ever heard of so far that really uses the cloud as a black box intermediate piece in a single application. Right, with Office, the next version, you're going to be able to deploy X number of apps on a desktop, and that same user can use different apps from the cloud and go back and forth. Data can be shared. They're really incorporating the cloud as a medium. Most other companies so far, you see the cloud as one place and the application in another place, and they may talk to each other, but they're definitely distinct separate entities. So what I'm hoping what I see with OpenStack is that kind of innovation on a much broader scale.
Cheebert, what about that? So I one of the comments that Oliver made, I think that is really poignant, is that VMware and Microsoft and Citrix to a certain extent are very much invested in making the solution work with their existing offerings. That's how you grow them. Whereas OpenStack kind of has that blue field advantage. They can kind of dream and do anything the way that they think it should be done on the internet. How does that affect how Microsoft develops its virtualization solutions, especially within, say, Server 2012?
Well, right now, everybody's got their own solution. Everybody's trying to sell their brand of dog food. And to a certain extent, all the big players do a really good job of it. Now, what's going to happen is I consider OpenStack to be kind of like the Libertarian or the Green Party in a political campaign. They know they don't have a chance in Snowball's chance in whatever's to win that race. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to get the incumbents to adopt their planks for their platform. So realistically, I look at OpenStack is they're going to force the big players to step up and add some of the things that OpenStack's going to do. I think that's what OpenStack's big value is going to be.
All right. Now, John, I want to throw this over to you. Will we be seeing sort of a multi-tenant approach to resource building. I mean, this is actually one of the things that some people have been a little snarky about with VMware, and that is you've had to change your billing approach. You've had to change how you license out resources, and for good reason, because virtualization brings up all these different new problems that existed before when you start dealing with virtualized resources versus actual physical resources that you have to buy. Where do you see this model going? I mean, if I'm running a small to medium business up to an enterprise and I start talking about virtualization, what can I expect all the players, the big three players, to be doing as far as how much it's going to cost me, what kind of resources I'm going to have to dedicate to it, what kind of billing plan I'm going to have to put myself on?
Sure. Well, VMware is really re-architecting its whole product suite around the cloud. We're calling it the vCloud suite. We allow you to go out and make a private cloud inside your own data center. We have thousands of cloud partners, so we're going to market with a lot of service providers that run vSphere and vCloud software in the cloud so that the same software that you use to run your workloads inside your own data center, you can then move them out seamlessly to a cloud provider. So that lets you run them out there. We have one of the components of the vCloud suite is the vCloud Director, and that's all about making elastic resource pools of storage, compute, networking that can then be allocated in a multi-tenant way, securely with protections against noisy neighbors and nosy neighbors, so that you can then draw that down and you can draw that down on a usage-based pattern of consumption. So whether that's usage-based inside your own enterprise, like one part of your IT organization doing chargeback or showback with another part, or from a service provider just charging you for what you use, just like Amazon does.
Right. Okay. Achiever, how does that compare to the model that Microsoft will be using in 2012?
Well, from what I understand, Microsoft in this case is Johnny Come Lately. The System Center 2012 for the first time really can step up and compete with vCenter and compete truly on the virtual multi-tenancy environment that VMware has had for quite a while. One of the things that I was really hoping for is more on the billing side. Multi-tenant and ISPs going to virtualization is a very big deal. It's going to start becoming important, especially as we start seeing more and more smart televisions. So that you can actually, instead of just buying an internet connection, you'll be able to buy a managed desktop from your local ISP. Multi-tenancy, being able to bill for it, being able to have the granularity to charge back for it is going to drive this industry like nothing else. The whole Amazon model was one of the things that I was really hoping to see as a commercial product someday, but so far, not so much.
Now, Curtis, okay, we're talking about multi-tenant billing. We're talking about resource allocation across different neighbors. What does that mean for someone who's just trying to deploy a small enterprise? When you can actually go out and buy your services from a multi-tenant resource pool, what does that do for how you deploy your IT, and what does that do for your bottom line?
Well, the nice thing about what it does for your bottom line is that it relieves you from the necessity of making a large capital investment before you can get off the ground. That was always one of the stumbling points for companies moving into what you might call small enterprise computing from the very small business model. It was a really large capital investment required. The multi-tenancy, or if you will, sort of public cloud kind of model, relieves the company of having to make that huge lump investment or tie themselves to a financing model that would soak up a lot of their line of credit over a period of 2 to 3 years. They can buy what they need as a service. If their business conditions change, they can change their contract, taking less or getting more as things require. It really does open them up to being able to get some of that traditional large enterprise power, functionality, and flexibility without having to have the large enterprise financial resources behind it. It's a great equalizer, and I think it's ultimately going to be huge for business as a whole as more and more companies understand what is possible.
Now, Oliver, let me throw this to you because you might have a slightly different perspective. I have heard that argument before, that this could be the huge equalizer, that a small business, small to medium business, all the way up to the small enterprise, can now play like the big enterprise because they can buy resources just when they need it, rather than having to put a huge capital outlay into big iron, into switching and server gear. But the counter argument is that really only big enterprise knows how to be able to leverage multi-tenant resources and multi-tenant pools. Where do you stand on that? Is this an equalizer, or is this something that's just too difficult for the small to medium business up to the small enterprise to use?
Well, I think currently I would go with it's going to be too difficult because it's all about the math, right? Admittedly, to Curtis's point, you may be able to start off cheaper at the outset. You don't have to outlay all the cash for a big data center. But I've heard several responses from people who've been with Amazon, for example, for a long time, saying that over time, those charges, it becomes hugely expensive. I think Zynga, for that article that I wrote, I did an interview with them. They had been using Amazon, and they literally had to retreat from using a verted model back into their own data centers because the cost just became crazy as their user load moved up. And Zynga might be a famous company, but they're not especially big, right? So for small, medium, you have to do the math, not just for the startup, but for the long term. Now, that said, I think as cloud computing matures, you're going to see dedicated offerings for small businesses. I believe Microsoft may actually be working on one, and I'm sure other people are. And once the pricing model shifts, like Rackspace has an Amazon competitor now, I think HP is either working or has one too, right? As soon as that price competition starts to happen, I think small businesses and medium-sized businesses are going to have a much easier time and a more value add when they choose those kind of services.
John, what do you think about that? I mean, so is it too difficult for a small to medium business to understand multi-tenant resource pools? What would be a way to make the process easier? What would be a way to make deployment easier? In other words, what is the way that you let virtualization scale all the way up from the small deployment to the very large?
The cool thing is the small business doesn't have to understand multi-tenancy because it's just one tenant. I think there's not going to be it's going to be a world of multiple clouds. And multiple clouds that are specialized for different things. It's not going to be just Amazon, Microsoft, VMware, Rackspace. There are community clouds, governments, universities, NASDAQ. People have all created clouds specifically for their stakeholders. You're going to see small business clouds that are tuned, that just make it tuned for small business, make it really easy to jump in. Already have, I mean, Microsoft's certainly going to do it. Other people are going to do it. They're going to have email, file servers, the rest of the services that you need as a small business turnkey, and it's going to be really easy to do. In fact, the same people that you're buying co-location from now, you'll just be buying cloud services from. So I think it'll be pretty easy for the small business just to jump in.
One of the points that you made there that I really like is it's not going to be just the big players, that we're going to start seeing cloud services and virtualization take off everywhere. So my question to you is, if that's going to happen, how do we see, especially the big three, VMware, Microsoft, and Citrix, how do we start to see their services converge so that they're not constantly beating up on one another, but they sort of do what they do best? Where is the natural equilibrium that we can expect to shake out over, say, the next 10 years?
Well, once you go to the cloud, the infrastructure layer becomes hidden. So I think for us folks, that we're the guys that are plugging in the cables and making the disks run, it's important to us. But for the consumer, for the small business IT guy, the what's running underneath becomes less apparent to you. I personally think that things running on VMware will be more robust and more cost efficient and more reliable than, for instance, things running on Amazon Cloud. But for the end users, for just the guy that needs his word processing and file storage, it doesn't really matter what the infrastructure will commodify. And you're already seeing the infrastructure just like it happened in the personal productivity market. In the old days, you used to have a whole RFP and a whole committee meeting to figure out which word processor to buy. And at some point, the personal productivity tools became merged into a suite. It was no longer part of your business differentiation to figure out the best word processing tool to use. You bought the thing that was the most powerful and the right price point. I think you'll see the same thing with cloud services. Already, with us, with VMware, there's the vCloud suite that bundles in a lot more than just a hypervisor into an offering.
Shebert, what do you think about that? You think Server 2012 and the future cloud service products from Microsoft are slowly going to fade into the background so that we really won't care what it's running on, and the functionality doesn't really differ that much from product to product?
Actually, when I Curtis and I wrote a book called Cloud Computing, Technologies and Strategies of the Ubiquitous Data Center, Chapter 10 was all about predictions. One of the predictions I made was someday, not sure when, we aren't going to care what's under there. We aren't going to care whether it's Linux-based, Windows-based, Mac OS X-based. We don't care because the apps are going to be able to move around. I actually made a prediction that someday we're going to start seeing little bot programs going out that can actually go out and start shopping the service. So kind of like the old service bureaus in the mainframe and mini computer days, you could actually shop your payroll runs. You could shop your AR runs. You can shop this and that. As we start getting more and more layers of abstraction, you know, there's going to be, you know, the underpinnings. We're going to have the VMware. We're going to have the Hyper-V. We're going to have the Zen server. But as things like OpenStack and open, you know, the open world starts getting more and more traction, I see maybe we'll have a cloud computing language of some sort that will go and drop into a lot of different environments.
Curtis, Web8117 in the chat room says, we don't care now. You know, with no standards, we honestly don't care now. We just want the services to work. Do you stand by that prediction in the book that you and Shebert wrote? I mean, are we moving towards that future, or is that future here already?
I think we're moving towards the future. And I think that initiatives like OpenStack are a step toward that future, because what we really would love to have, and I think what a lot of enterprises would love to have, pardon me, is a standard. You know, we talked earlier in the discussion about multi-tenancy, about how you can have something that works economically if you're a small business with small needs, but as your needs grow, that same supplier, that same provider might not be a good economic solution any longer. If you had a standard, though, some standard language, some standard framework, some standard way of making virtualization and the cloud happen, then it would become easy to move from, say, a supplier that specializes in small business solutions to one that specializes in large enterprise solutions, and then perhaps even to your own dedicated solution once you pass a particular size. That is, I think, the ultimate end game. Now, how long it'll take us to get there, no one knows. But I think we've started down the path, and I truly do believe that there are an awful lot of big customers out there that are going to be pushing the vendors to keep walking down this path.
Oliver, you're sort of becoming the John C. Dvorak of TWiET, the grumpy old geek. Is this all pie in the sky? I mean, are we kidding ourselves? Or, I mean, is this actually coming into place?
Dude, I think that sample that you just mentioned, that testing project you just mentioned that your guys were working on, where they wound up going with Office 365, I think that's a perfect example. People don't care now. Everything you and I and everyone here is talking about is because we're back-end geeks. It's important to us. Somebody out front, they just want to work. What's underneath, who cares? That's why Office 365, I think, is doing so well, right? What people want, unfortunately, is Microsoft Office. They kind of own the world there. So that's the best service for it. It's free. It's not free, but it's for rent. It's the most reliable version of that software that you can get from the cloud. And pow, it's going to win for now. To Curtis's point, though, yeah, I think it'd be great from an enterprise standpoint if we could commoditize that. If Office were able to be cloudized across multiple standards, that would rock. But you know, is Microsoft going to let that happen? I don't know.
All right. I want to give one last go around the horn, starting with Oliver. What would you say are two things that the end user needs to know about virtualization?
Two things the end user needs to know about virtualization. One, I think it is the most cost-effective way to manage a data center today. If you're not doing it, you better start. And two, we didn't talk too much about VDI, but I think you should definitely look at virtualizing your desktops. That can be huge cost savings, and it can give you flexibility that just can't be found in a standard client-server model.
All right. And to Curtis, what would two things you would want enterprise users to know about virtualization?
Well, I think the two big things for the enterprise to know about virtualization is that if you do it right, then your end user never knows that it's happening. The other thing is to take advantage of all of the multiplicity of devices that are now in the user hands as a way of introducing the concept of virtualization. If you can give people a consistent interface into their enterprise applications through VDI on tablets, on laptops, on desktops, then you get rid of an awful lot of resistance to the idea.
All right. And Brian, what would two things be that you would want the small to medium business user to know about virtualization?
I really want people to think about asking your peers, talking to them, and don't believe the salesman. Try it out for yourself. Every single one of these big players have demo copies. They'll work for 30 or 90 days. Just try it, for God's sakes. Don't, you know, the salesman wants to close that sale. You know, it's in your best interest to try it and make sure it fits. One size does not fit all at this moment.
And you get the last word because you're our in-studio guest, our honored guest. What would two things be that you would want the post-PC world to know about virtualization?
Well, I think as an end user, I think you should expect that IT delivers the applications that you need on the any device that you need to use, whether it's an iPad, a tablet, a phone, a wristwatch, or your desktop. I think it's a little bit ironic. And as an IT person, I think it's be aware that this multi-device world is happening. I like the word multi-device world better than post-PC because PC's not going away. The mainframe didn't go away. So the PCs are going to be around. It's just that we're going to be using lots of devices. I've got three or four devices on me right now, and they all connect to the same resources. So I think for the IT department, you need to realize that you know, it's not a single device world. And a little bit ironic that we talked about virtual desktop infrastructure anymore because the desktop no longer is becoming the center of access to applications and data. Users and data, that's exploding, right? That's in the cloud. That's in Dropbox. That's in other service providers. You get access to your data. So I think it's definitely a multi-device world, and IT needs to not put the no in innovation and actually help facilitate this, or your users are going to go outside.
Well, thank you very much to the entire panel. Again, I believe that's the end of our time. You've used up all the time to talk about virtualization and VDI, and this will be the last time we'll ever have to talk about it, right?
I think it's going away.
Yeah,
it's pretty much a fad.
It's fad. It's done now. But before we do,
I can't let you go without a word from our friends at SAP. The conversation today is all about social. It's how we know what's going on. It's how people converse. It's all about the blogger who writes a review about a product that he likes. Or a Facebook post from a woman who had a great customer service experience. Or a tweet from a customer service fail. This is how we know what to trust. This is how brands succeed. And ultimately, this is what makes or breaks the enterprise. If you work in the enterprise today, this can be problematic, both because of the sheer volume of social media content, but also because we need a way to qualify it. We need to know what's being said, who's saying it, and more importantly, how do we respond? This is why we need to take a look at social media solutions from SAP. Social media solutions from SAP helps large enterprises listen and engage with social media in a systematic way. The listening component searches the social web in a smart way to know what is being said about your brand. It captures and reports on conversations about relevant terms, passions, patterns, and competitors. It surfaces sentiment and the intensity of it. For example, do your customers like, love, or dislike something? It helps you build better products by incorporating real-time customer feedback into your innovation efforts. It helps you identify customers who are ready to buy based on buying signals they are sending via social media, and it uses natural language processing to intelligently and automatically know the difference between similar statements, such as, this app has never been good, and this app has never been this good. The engaging component is the second part of SAP's social media solution service. It's the part that allows you to program certain actions based on the social media content coming in. If you have someone tweeting that they're having a technical problem, it can send that to customer service. If you have someone who the software has indicated is ready to buy because of a Facebook post or a blog post, it sends it over to sales. It lets you set the parameters for your engagement, meaning that social media works for you rather than against you. Social Media Solutions from SAP gives you an accurate and real-time understanding of your brand's social media performance. If you manage the social media presence for a large, regional, or national enterprise, get in touch with SAP. Find out more at sap.com/twit. And we thank SAP for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Well, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to This Week in Enterprise Tech. I want to thank all our panelists for their opinions, for their facts, for bringing us to the pinnacle of enterprise tech. Now, I do want to ask you out there right now, if you are listening to this on a download, why not stop by live? We tape every Monday at noon Pacific. And if you go to the Twit page at twit.tv/Twiet, you'll be able to find out all the different ways you can download. And if you go to irc.twit.tv, you'll be able to join us in the live chat room. It's a place where some of the most brilliant people in the world gather to talk about their passion for technology. Also, if you are listening to this on a download, be aware that we've got other versions available. If you want to watch it on your computer, you can download the standard definition version. Or if you want to watch it on the couch in front of your big screen TV with a loved one, download us in high definition so you can get all of our geeky goodness. Also, follow me at Twitter, at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll be able to vote on what we talk about in future episodes of Twiet, or just tell me where I'm wrong, because I love to hear that. Also, I want to thank everyone here in the Brick House. Being away for a while, it's really made me realize how fun it is to be here in Petaluma. We've got TD extraordinaire. We've got a producer who's fantastic. We've got a support group that just is second to none. Well, before we go, I do want to give our panel a chance to, well, plug whatever it is they want to plug. So let's start with Oliver. Oliver, what do you want our viewers to know about?
Just the fact that I'm very handsome. I guess, yeah, keep looking for coverage on InfoWorld that will cover all virtualization, including OpenStack and VDI. That coverage is ongoing, so keep checking back there regularly, and you'll get more.
Curtis, what's going on in the enterprise efficiency?
We're getting into our fall season of full multimedia goodness. We've got video seminars. We've got E2 Radio. We've got our community going on. Twiet is a wonderful thing. We're grateful for everyone here. Come on over to enterpriseefficiency.com. Join the community there. We'd love to have your voices in the conversation at Enterprise Efficiency.
And Chibert, the man of many hats, what hat are you wearing today?
I am wearing the hat that I am an InterruptNet team volunteer. If someone's going to be in the New York tri-state area and feels like visiting us over at the Jacob Javits Center, the first week of October is the Interop Trade Show. Come and knock on the glass wall in the knock, and Padre and I are both going to be living there for about a week.
Yeah, actually, I'll join you in saying that we want you to join us in Interop because it's going to be fantastic. Now, our special guest, what do you have going on in your world that's not virtualized?
I live 100% virtualized life, pretty much. But let's see, if people want to say hi, I'm always on Twitter, at Jay Troyer. I'll be in Barcelona, actually, right after this airs. So if you on October 9th through the 11th, if you go to vmworld.com, you can see us broadcasting live tech talks, little 10-minute tech talks straight from Barcelona, from the European crowd. And actually, I am also live and in person and a little bit virtual every week on my podcast. If people are interested in VMware and virtualization, just check out the just go ahead and Google the VMware Community Roundtable. We're live on Wednesdays at noon.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Good to know. And thank you for watching. Remember, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiet.